You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Protests on the streets of Bujumbura as Burundi buries the highest profile victim yet of the violence attending President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to defy the country's constitution and stand for a third term. Mary Dajewski and Phil Clark will be here to discuss the murder of Zedi Feretsi and the day's other big stories, including an apparent right turn by the voters of Poland, who will and who won't be able to vote on the UK's future in the EU, and Vladimir Putin's ongoing efforts to ban people from disagreeing with him. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist at The Independent, and Phil Clark from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS here in London. Welcome both back to Midori House. Now, if nothing else, May 2015 has been quite the month for aficionados of surprise election results. Here in the UK, despite universally confident predictions of a hung parliament, voters returned a majority Conservative government. In Spain, local elections presaged a possible overturning of the established order nationally later this year. And this weekend in Poland, voters have thanked President Bronislaw Komorowski for his country's record of growth and stability by tipping him out. Mary, Poland, how big a surprise is this?
Well, it was less of a surprise this Sunday when people voted, but the real surprise was that there had to be a runoff because it was widely expected that Bronisław Komorowski, who had been in office and had steered what was seen to be entirely competently the ship of Poland, that he was forced into a runoff. So the moment he was forced into a runoff, then people thought, aha, well, you know, it is possible that he could be evicted, and that's exactly what happened.
So as Mary was pointing out, Poland had a reputation for being quite a relatively prosperous and well-run country. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that in the last 20 years, it's the only country not to have suffered a recession in Europe. What are their voters so grumpy about?
Quite staggering. A country that's had 11 or 12% growth for the best part of the last 7 or 8 years. But it seems that the population is grumpy about a couple of things. One seems to be that unemployment is still very high, despite this enormous growth. So it's a country that also happens to have 11% unemployment, which is quite staggering given the rate of growth. And the ruling party had started to do things like increase the retirement age. So it seems like massive growth, but the bulk of the population hasn't benefited from this. So people seem quite angry.
Is it possible to tell whether, because this is a discussion that obviously attended the Conservative victory here in the UK, as to whether people can be persuaded to vote against their own economic interests, how often people do, etc., etc. Is that what's happened in Poland? Is it the economy, comma, stupid? That is, you know, paraphrasing. Obviously, I'm not addressing you as such. Are Poles grumpy about other things? Do they think the country is going in the wrong direction? There's been much talk about the president elect Duda and what his more, I guess, assertive foreign policy might mean for Poland. Is that the kind of thing that people are making decisions about?
I think there's a bit of that. I think there's also, along with the economic problems that a lot of Poles think and really know that they still have, is there is the glaring contrast between even the success of Poland and the living standards elsewhere in what they don't like being called old Europe. Because a lot of Poles, you know, if you think of how many Poles are actually living and working in Britain, those emigres and their families have a very clear idea of the persisting gap in living standards. And I think that a lot of them have become rather impatient. You know, you talk about growth over this many years, but I think they can't quite understand why it is that this gap in living standards still persists. Now, you know, you and I might say, well, if you look at where Poland was 20 years ago and where Poland is now, then you would say a near miracle has happened. But it's not happening nearly fast enough or comprehensively enough for most Poles.
What do you think, Phil? Is it just that kind of economic thing where people experience that disconnect that Mary's talking about between what the economy is supposed to be doing on paper and how it feels, in their everyday life? Or is there, and I guess yoking this into the elections in the UK and Spain as well, is there kind of a sort of, I don't know, proto-nationalist grumpiness at large in Europe? Because though the votes for the grumpy vote, if you will, in Spain tended more leftward, there's a real resentment gathering of the European Union and of supranational entities.
I think that is part of it. And it seems in the Polish case, there's a sense of frustration that so much of the country's talent and so much of its wealth has fled out of the borders. And it seems that Poles aren't big on remittances, so there hasn't been much flow back of kind of the benefits of European integration. So, which I guess on one hand is kind of an understandable frustration with the state of affairs, but it's hardly the fault of this government, I would have thought. So comprehensible motivations on the part of the voters, but why it's been directed in this particular way seems a bit baffling to me.
Well, I mean, people tend to blame the government of the day whether things that are wrong are their problem or not. I mean, that's kind of the rule. You take the credit, you accept the blame. Mary, do you think, though, that there is a kind of... Is it just politics, or is it just the economy, or is there a nationalism starting to bubble in Europe?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I was at a gathering of Poles in London as the election results came in. And the interesting thing was that aside from the emigration in London being almost split down the middle as to the result they wanted, when you saw the concession speech of Komorowski and when you saw the acceptance speech of Andrzej Duda, you saw there were the sort of flickers of a charisma and something akin, you don't like to call it personality cult, but there was the sort of shouting and the adoration and the sort of sense of somebody being there who appealed to the popular streak in a way that Komorowski didn't. And while a lot of people find this appealing, I actually looked at it and thought, well, almost there you have as good an argument for having a monarchy as you can probably think of.
Well, on a semi-related, or at least not entirely unrelated note, another vote that will already be causing night sweats in pollsters is the UK's referendum on membership of the EU, which is now due to occur before the end of 2017, I think I'm right in saying. Rules on eligibility have been released. Other than UK citizens, residents who are citizens of the EU's former British colonies, Malta and Cyprus, will get a vote, as do resident Commonwealth citizens. So I'm pretty excited about that, I can tell you. Other resident EU citizens, however, and Brits who have lived abroad longer than 15 years do not. That, unless I'm missing something here, Phil, I'll put this to you. That strikes me as about fair enough, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, it is the same set of rules that governs, the general election that's just passed and every general election that anyone can seem to remember. So it's not unusual in that sense. I mean, like you as a sort of member of the colonies who's come home to roost, you know, bread thieves coming back for what they felt was rightly theirs, but they missed out on the first time around. It does kind of baffle me that we still get this chance to vote. I mean, it's a rare moment of British generosity, one that I tend to exploit to the absolute hilt. So, yes, nothing too disturbing in these rules, I don't think.
Mary, what do you think? Because I have mixed feelings about this. As an Australian who's lived out of Australia for a long time, I'm not allowed vote anymore in Australia, which I think is fair enough in parliamentary elections because I don't pay taxes in Australia, I don't live there. But I do think I should get a vote in referenda. I'm an Australian citizen and these things affect a country to which I may one day return and where my family still is. Should that be the way it's delineated? Because it struck me as absurd during the Scottish referendum. I have to say that EU citizens resident in Scotland were allowed the vote, which means theoretically if it had been really, really close, the United Kingdom could have been broken up by a few thousand Latvians who were only living there for a few months.
Yes, I mean, Scotland invoked the rules that generally apply to local elections in the UK, that EU citizens resident here can vote. I actually wanted to spoil sorry, to spoil the party for you two a little bit.
Please
because
do.
I think it's a huge anachronism that Commonwealth citizens have a vote in UK elections.
To be honest, I tend to agree with you.
And we wouldn't extend it to you in Australia either.
Exactly. I actually think it's time to stop it. And actually not just the Commonwealth, but also votes for Irish citizens in the UK. That seems to me to be a throwback, an almost sort of old-style colonial throwback of not wanting to let former colonies and former parts of your country go. I think it's time to stop this. But I understand why those rules are going to come into effect for the referendum, because I think speed is of the essence here. And the last thing you want to hold things up is to have a huge argument in Parliament about changing the rules in various directions. So I think it's probably a sensible decision.
Well, another key difference between this and the rules attending the Scottish referendum is that the Scottish referendum extended the franchise to 16 and 17-year-olds. This one will not, as per usual. Is there an argument here, given that this is a vote on the future, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Phil, what do you think?
I don't think so, although I have enjoyed the SNP using this as their first major foray into UK politics to differentiate themselves from everybody else, to say, look, it worked so well for us north of the border. We have all these very excited young voters now. They're much more excited than the older generation. You should do the same here. So it's not, no, I don't think there's a reasonable argument for this yet, but interesting to see the Scots start to weigh in a way that we will have to become accustomed to over the next 4 or 5 years.
I speak as somebody who basically thinks the voting age should be raised at any given moment to about a year younger than whatever I happen to be myself, which is a fair distance from 17 at this point. But Mary, there is that argument. If they work, they pay taxes, they can join the army, although not serve in combat. Should they therefore be entitled to a vote?
Well, I find more attractive the argument that says, you know, it's their future, so you should have, as it were, a younger demographic voting on these sort of things. But I would actually operate things in reverse. I think that 18 ought to be the age of majority for everything. So that would be for voting, for driving, for getting married, for serving in the armed forces. All those things would come into operation at 18, and forget this discrepancy between 16 and 18, because there used to be a discrepancy between 21 and 18 when they first reduced the voting age. I think everything should be consolidated at 18, and 16 is actually that's a sort of rogue default that really we should forget.
I guess just a final thought on this from each of you before we move on to other things. What are your expectations for this campaign about as we come to the referendum, Phil? Do you think we will actually manage to have in this country a sensible conversation about Europe, or will it be the usual?
I am so loath to make predictions now after the general election, where it seems like anything that looked like predictability and sanity beforehand went out the window on the night. But my sense is, when it all boils down, I think Britain will vote to stay in the European Union, but I suspect we're going to have a fairly ugly national debate about it on the way there. And every manner of Europhobic nutcase is going to come out of the woodwork and be given a very national platform to air their fairly abhorrent views. And that's going to go on for a year and a half. So I worry about the process that will lead to hopefully still quite a sane result.
Because it strikes me, Mary, and a final thought from you on this, that more so, I mean, I think it's true of most elections, but in this one in particular, I think more so than most, there will be on both sides a facsimile or a performance of a logical argument, but people will vote emotionally.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, exactly the same thing happened in Scotland, and it's entirely right, I think, to draw parallels between the two, because many of the arguments are actually the same. And I suppose if I were betting on it, I'd say that the result would probably pretty much be much the same too.
Okay, well, let's look now at an election in which a surprise result would be extremely surprising, which is the presidential poll due in Burundi, where President Pierre Nkurunziza intends to stand for a third term next month, despite the prohibition of the constitution he's supposed to be upholding. His decision to proceed has so far resulted in an attempted coup d'etat and sporadic violence, among victims of which has been opposition figure Zedi Feruzi, whose funeral was held yesterday. Phil, I guess, first of all, a bit of background. background. Who was he, and why was his funeral so well attended?
Yeah, I mean, Feruzi is a relatively minor opposition leader in Burundi. He was the leader of, you know, probably the third or fourth largest opposition party. There's this entire constellation of Burundian parties, most of which had some sort of former rebel background. His party didn't have a rebel background, so they're a little bit unusual in that regard. But I think the reason why so many people turned out to his funeral yesterday, I mean, there were figures of something like 7,000 or 8,000 people, which is quite remarkable given the prevailing violent atmosphere. I think the reason so many people turned out was the symbolism of this, that this is the first prominent figure to be killed in this period of protests. It's people coming out perhaps not necessarily to commemorate him as an individual, but to capture this moment and I guess express their continued opposition to the presidency. So I think that's why there's been so much fanfare around this particular assassination.
Just staying with you on that, Phil, a lot of oppositions now say they are in or are going to be in hiding for the duration, which is obviously going to make campaigning fairly difficult. At least 100,000 Burundians are reported to have fled the country, which is not a vote of optimism in the immediate future. In terms of the violence that is taking place against opposition figures, is it possible to tell how organised it looks?
It's pretty organised. I think definitely the government is more organised on the streets of Bujumbura than the opposition is at this stage. We've seen increasingly elements of the army start to join the police in targeting the protesters. That's one of the big shifts in the last 4 or 5 days. Up until that point, it had really been the police operating in a fairly rogue fashion, and the army were being praised for standing in between the police and the protesters. That's beginning to shift in the last few days, and we're getting this more kind of coordinated government front against the protesters. But on the other side of the equation, that the opposition is massively divided. And even within the protest movement itself, this is a very, very fragmented, which is one of the reasons why the protests ebb and flow. There are massive numbers out on the streets one day and then almost no one the next. So Nkurunziza knows that. He knows that the opposition's hugely divided. And as long as he can keep things kind of vaguely in control over the next week or two, he believes he can stay in power and possibly even run these sham elections in 4 or 5 weeks' time.
Nkurunziza, Mary, he's clearly, he's telling the world and certainly himself that, you know, he's entitled to stay in the job because clearly he's the only man who can save the country from itself. It's a dynamic that is familiar around the world. In a situation like this, and as the world watches what's happening in Burundi, you know, the portion of the world with memories of the country next door in 1994 is all thinking the same thing. Is there anything forces outside Burundi could or should do?
I find it difficult to see really anything that anyone can do. I think if you're looking for a sliver of optimistic anything in what looks like a hugely chaotic and potentially probably even violent situation, it is that the president's effort to get himself a third term and to breach the constitution has actually been met by opposition. So he's made life probably more difficult for himself than he actually intended. And I think the fact that people understand that this actually isn't how to do things. So while there is a sort of perception of how democracy ought to work, I think all is not lost. But obviously, you know, you're looking at a long process, you're looking at an election which could be preceded by violence, which may not happen, which when it does will probably be rigged, and it's not a happy situation.
Phil, another sliver of optimism, aside from that one Mary mentioned, is that according to all reports so far, the violence has not been sectarian. There is no sort of apparently organised, coordinated, concerted Hutu versus Tutsi violence. Why, and I'm not trying to tempt fate here, but why isn't that happening?
Yeah, this is a very peculiar sort of optimistic point in all of this, that we've kind of replaced an ethnic logic with a completely different logic of conflict, which is everybody is united in their hatred of Nkurunziza at the moment, except for a very tiny sort of remnant within the military. I mean, I think the reason for that is that Burundian politics genuinely has changed in the last 10 years, that this, at least at the national level, this attempt to form an executive and to configure an army along non-ethnic grounds largely has worked. And, you know, the international community has played an important role in bringing about that particular political settlement. The problem, though, is that another step needed to take place, which was to insist upon robust democratic institutions and, in particular, a judiciary that would be safeguarded against the president's interference. And the international community, I think, kind of backed out before that kind of hard work was done. There was this view that as long as you dealt with the ethnic situation, everything else would fix itself. What we're seeing at the moment is the categorical proof that, more needed to be done.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark. Coming up next, Vladimir Putin does something illiberal and paranoid. It's kind of a slow news day. And China instructs its officials in the reality of the relationship between crime and punishment.
It's full steam ahead with the new transport-themed issue of Monocle that includes our survey of the best in class from cars to trams, planes to trains. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the affairs section, we take to the subsidised skies in Montana, Queensland and Wales to find out why small airlines need big backing.
In this month's business section, we take up the transport theme with a visit to the small Japanese city of Kanazawa, put on the business and tourist map by the new Hokuriku Shinkansen, which began service in March.
In culture, we tackle transport by looking at art movers, the unsung multi-billion dollar arm of the art world.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark. Now, the copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People on Vladimir Putin's nightstand languished unthumbed yet again this weekend. The Russian president signed off on a new law giving prosecutors the power to close down foreign organizations working in Russia, a move which is not widely believed an encouragement to Western NGOs in particular and civil society in general. I'm not even sure where to start with this, Mary. This law was floated a while ago. Is Vladimir Putin lying awake at night afeared of the predations of Amnesty International, or is he just pretending to for political gain?
Well, I think there is a degree of political gesture about this, that if you have people who are more conservative and less democratic even than Putin around you, then there is going to be pressure for these sort of laws. Now, as I understand it, this is actually a slightly different sort of law. There have been, I think it's the third of a series. The first two were about NGOs working in Russia accepting foreign funds. This one, I think, is slightly different because I'm not sure that it's the foreign funding aspect of it. I think it's what the work of the organisation is perceived to be and whether it can be, whether it opens itself to criticism and prosecution for, I think, in the words of the law, jeopardising national security, defence, and those sort of things. So I think that there's an interesting aspect to this because it suggests that one of the developments of the previous two laws has been that there are actually now homegrown Russian NGOs operating to a degree with a sort of, you know, mild oppositionist sort of flavour. And it looks to me as though this law is actually targeting them because the other two laws relating to foreign money don't apply.
Just sticking with you, though, Mary, among the many things I don't quite understand about this sequence of laws is if he's trying to at least give the appearance, and all tyrannies and pseudo-tyrannies do always try to give the appearance of being a sort of open, transparent democracy. Even North Korea is officially the Democratic People's Republic thereof. Shouldn't he be at least be saying, sure, if people want a civil society and NGOs and to monitor human rights, fine, we've got nothing to hide, knock yourselves out.
Yes, but I think you've got a large constituency of Russians who actually see NGOs of all variety as a potential threat. So that it is sort of playing to a particular gallery in Russia to be passing these sort of laws. I also think that you do have to see this to an extent, not this law, but the other two laws relating to foreign funding. You really should see this in a more international context, because Russia is by no means the only country. Russia, the United States, India, the UK to an extent, has laws and restrictions on foreign money in politics. And in a way, the laws in Russia are designed in a very clumsy way to be replicas of that. They sometimes cite in their defence that America has quite strict strict regulations on foreign money coming into American politics. So they say that some of their legislation, at least, has been modelled on American legislation. And I think, you know, you do have to accept that there is an issue about foreign money in politics, wherever it comes from and wherever it goes to.
Indeed. So, Phil, is that a reasonable point in this case, though, or is Vladimir Putin basically just fashioning a stick to beat civil society with?
I'm always fascinated, because this is the kind of tactic that we see in many of the African countries where I do my research, to kind of frame all human rights movements and all civil society groups as, by definition, foreign. And the counterpoint to that is this idea that the domestic space is pure, that it's orderly, and these groups could only these civil society groups could only be functioning if they were kind of agents of the outside. That there's no space for kind of a grassroots movement. They must have been kind of goaded to do this by these kind of foreign influences. So that's kind of fascinating. The type of idea of Russia that Putin is trying to fashion by putting in place this kind of legislation. That the other sort of element of this that fascinates me is the wonderful overstatement of the power of groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And my friends who work at those sort of groups say, if only we had the kind of influence kind of law sort of assumes. You know, most of us are kind of licking stamps and, you know, kind of, you know, sending envelopes out into the ether hoping for the best. You know, that if only we were the ogre, in fact, that someone like Putin makes us out to be.
They could try looking at it as the sincerest form of flattery, I guess. Finally, though, we should look to China, because as part of what is either China's stringent anti-corruption drive or the Chinese Communist Party's mechanism for whacking potential opposition, Chinese officials have been sent, this is glorious, have been sent on prison tours to visit former colleagues who don't have the option of going home again. Mary, would this work? I mean, I'm just trying to think of a journalistic equivalent.
Well, I was trying very hard to think of a UK equivalent and think, well, you know, might this actually be quite a good idea? I mean, is this what we should be doing with the banking fraternity? Should we be taking them around the cells? It might actually produce some sort of pressure to improve the conditions. Or on the other hand, it might say they're actually living too cushy a life. So I think maybe there's some sort of foreign replication that could be recommended here.
I mean, I do remember people making the joke at the time when the phone hacking scandal in this country's tabloid newspapers resulted in jail sentences, that the journalists who generally received them had been the ones who'd been saying for years that prisons were just like holiday camps, so really they didn't have anything to worry about. Phil, this has provoked, though, apparently quite a large order of online mirth. Does that suggest that maybe there is a younger Chinese generation that isn't kind of buying this stuff? Because this does have echoes of the whole cultural revolution, self-criticism, kneeling with a sign around your neck while people wave little red books at you thing about it, doesn't it?
Yeah, this has been a regular topic, I think, on Midori House, that what do we make of the Chinese anti-corruption push, and should we interpret this as, you know, a reformist government that is trying to hold its own members accountable? But it does seem online that the view is this is another form of performative politics and we shouldn't take this too seriously. I have to say, having read these articles, I don't don't think I'll ever complain again about academic departmental away days where we get told, you know, this is what this year is going to look like. Let's compare a few ideas, given that these 70 officials and their spouses, I like that detail that the spouses also have been subjected to these prison visits. So, never again will I complain.
On that note, we will have to leave it there. Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Manetta. Our studio manager was Chris Grimes. For the next half hour, Ben Ryland will be keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Rob Bound is here with The Culture Show at 1900 hours UK time, at 2200 hours. I'm back with Dominic Reynolds for tonight's Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.